the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the next episode of the Agile Uprising Podcast. My name is Troy Lightfoot, and with me, I have James Gifford, Andrew Leff, and Jay Herskow. Today, we're going to be talking about BRDs, business requirement documents, versus or user stories. So to start off, let's talk about the Agile Uprising Coalition. So we have listener questions. So the first listener question we have comes from Allison Wood. And the question is, what are the most common challenges with Agile? Now, this is probably a podcast topic in its own, right? But see if we can go around the horn and just give one quick answer to that question. Who would like to start?
I'll start. So okay. This is Andrew. I love this question. So to me, some of the bigger challenges that I encounter when I'm doing client-based work is around the thought process that you buy Agile, you unbox it, you install it, and then the organization is just Agile. So it's really that adoption and transformation effort is organizationally a challenge, and it's not just sort of an instance or, you know, an off-the-shelf solution. So walking through that process is one of the biggest challenges I encounter.
I'll go next. One of the biggest common challenges I think I've encountered in any type of Agile adoption and transformation is actually the title of what's going to be an upcoming podcast is the role of middle management inside the transformation. A place for everything and everything for its place. And obviously people are concerned about their role. And if you look at most of how Agile is deployed, especially at the enterprise level, there isn't a clearly defined role or place for a middle manager, even in a framework as large as SAFe. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, everyone comes down to their own personal motivations and where do I fit in the grander scheme of things. So finding a spot for a middle manager and get them engaged is usually for me, almost a linchpin or turning point in going from a men's amends Agile adoption to a full-blown transformation. So my answer is middle management finding their place.
And this is James. So, I mean, a lot of what I ultimately see is a challenge is people's, you know, technical infrastructure, their deployment pipeline. They don't necessarily look at that. You know, they'll go install Scrum, but they don't go fix the build process, how to get things actually into the environments. And it's slow and laborious. So, like, instead of focusing on good hygiene and you know, actually being able to continuously deploy or continuously integrate into those lower levels, we focus on the actual process of Scrum and not really any of the other mechanics or improvement in it, you know, and so it creates a lot of dysfunction, and people are using Scrum more as that project management framework as opposed to the true empirical process that it is, where it's learning adaptive. You know, Scrum, when it comes in, it assumes that you're doing XP. XP assumes that you have good version control, pipeline management. So, like, if you go into an Agile adoption and you have a terrible build process, it's going to struggle. And people aren't focusing on that lower level detail when they go to do these adoptions.
Gotcha. And excellent. And for me, I would say going into an organization where people think that Scrum is Agile, and they don't really know much about Agile or the reason why Agile exists or what it's supposed to be. And they basically just think that it's, you know, sprint planning and stand-up meetings and story points and et cetera, right? So they basically don't have that background in Agile or understanding of it. So that's a challenge, I would say. All right. So anybody else have any other thoughts about this topic?
Oh. Yeah, I think we literally just scratched the surface.
Okay, very good.
We barely put a scratch on this, but you know.
All right, so who would like to kick this off with the problem or the initial starting point of this conversation? Jay or Andrew?
Lef, what, you're the one who's deep in the weeds on this one. So you start it off and we'll piggyback from there.
So this topic came about for me. I don't know if it's what sparked the sort of topic tonight to discuss, but for me it was around, I got asked a question, what's the difference between a business requirement and a user story? And, you know, I think to me that they are different. You know, if you go off the true definition of what a business requirement is, as opposed to a user story, they read even differently. So, you know, according to the BA Book of Knowledge, the BABOK, you know, a requirement is a condition or a capability needed by a stakeholder to solve a problem or achieve an objective. You know, or it could be a condition or a capability that must be met or possessed by a solution or solution component to satisfy a contract standard specification or other formally imposed document, as well as a documented representation of a coordination or capability. So it's just confusing even at that point. I mean, yeah. It's really, what is the business value? What are we trying to define? So when I was writing requirements, it took me months of working with various business folks and identified key stakeholders to, you know, extract that conversation out of them, to extract the what. And it was very hard in my experience, and, you know, being a business analyst for as long as I was, to get that information out of a stakeholder. So it was very hard to describe what they wanted, in my experience. I'll pause there.
Well, I was going to say that we recently interviewed John Kern for the Manifesto Review Project, and just putting a plug in there, it's on the Coalition. So if you go to agileuprising.com, you can check that interview out. And it's interesting that the thing that kind of sparked his delve into what eventually became Agile was business requirement documents. That was kind of his first thing he said in this interview, that he was working with the Department of Defense and they were working on BRDs for 9 months before they were even coding anything. So he thought that was insane. So he wanted to create a lightweight version of that and kind of get rid of the BRD process. I just wanted to chime in about that. That was kind of interesting coming from John. What that was kind of his passion was the documentation.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, because, you know, having written massive documentation, especially, you know, coming from, you know, banking, where literally you could write 1,600 pages of documentation, and it was just I don't believe that anyone really ever read it. Right. Well, so the BA became like the most knowledgeable person to basically clearly understand, or at least become the author of this, you know, documentation that very few people read. And it was a handoff, right? So you wrote it, you handed it off, and then the development cycle kicked in. And how do you really know that everyone understands what they're even developing?
And I mean, that's a good point. And one thing that when we look at these requirements, you know, I spent some time in pharma. I spent some time in the manufacturing industry. I've spent some time in the financial industry, and each one of them has a different version of that requirements document. So when you talk about these lengthy, deep, detailed documents, are you talking about the King's English that the system shalleth do X, Y, and Z, like a one-liner title? Or are you talking about the detail that sits in that actual functional requirements document, Andrew? When you're talking about that 600-page document, you know, in most of the traditional ones that I've ever looked at and actually physically had to code from, they were the one-liner. The system shall doeth this, and some sub-bullets.
That's what I'm talking about. The system shall, you know, allow the user to, you know, X, Y, and Z. The system shall, you know, enable this, blah, blah, blah. So it was very one line, very what focused, and, you know, accounting in that direction. So it did not break it. And then you would break into whether you went into a JAD session or however you wanted to further break down that requirement. But there was literally, it would start off with just those sort of the system shall or the user shall, whatever it may be. So the bulleted to your point or to your first point.
And the assumption with writing the system shall is that you're assuming that the person who's actually authoring these requirements, the person who's giving the analyst the information that needs to go into those requirements, is knowledgeable enough about not only the system, but the infrastructure, but the technology footprint, that they can speak at length and knowledgeably about the requirements that they're trying to elucidate, right? So somebody tells you, I need a ham sandwich. If you just take them at face value, okay, you'll give her a ham sandwich and they'll say, well, I don't want a ham sandwich. But if you would ask, well, what do you really need? And they say, well, I'm really hungry and I want some type of sandwich. I think that's a healthier discussion, and it actually changes the whole narrative, let alone the way you interact with the business, quote unquote, sponsor, analyst, what have you.
But you kind of touched on that, Jay. And when you got to the point where I'm hungry, it's because that original business business requirements document is talking about the what I need, not the why I need it.
But also, I think they're more finite in construction. So literally, you write those business requirements, and you know, I joke about this in some of the coaching sessions that we have, that you know, they're not written in stone tablets anymore, right? So we can change them, but it seems like with business requirements, they don't change. It's a snapshot and it's locked. Unlike, you know, sort of going into the user story, it's a discussion, you know. And I think I was talking about this earlier, and I'm not sure if I brought this up with the group or with someone else around, you know, is it to have a really high quality user story, or is it to have a really good collaborative conversation? So I think that's sort of, you know, I know I'm jumping into the user story discussion, but I think it's polarized, because requirements, you don't necessarily have that deep collaborative conversation because you're trying to write, you know, the perfect requirement. In a user story, it's a much, you know, you could have a very open-ended high-level user story, and then you drill down into the conversation based upon that user story, and it's smaller. A requirement could be huge, right? It could be, you know, if we have to translate, it could be an epic, it could be a feature, it could span, you know, could create 1,000 stories from one requirement. So
before we head over into discussing user stories, Troy, we didn't get a chance to give you to weigh in yet. So what are your thoughts, feelings, experiences in regards to requirements, documentation, elicitation?
Well, actually, I wanted to read, since Leff read something, I would like to read something as well. So, okay. And this
is not be poetry.
This will give some background into the topic, I think. So this comes from Extreme Programming Explained, Ken Peck. And it reads, software development has been steered wrong by the word requirement, defined in the dictionary as something mandatory or obligatory. The word carries a connotation of absolutism and permanence, inhibitors to embrace change, and the word requirement is just plain wrong. One out of 1,000 pages of requirements, if you deploy a system with the right 20, 10, or even 5%, you will likely realize all the business benefit envisioned for the whole system. So what are the other 80%? Not requirements. They weren't really mandatory or obligatory. And he goes on to say, early estimation is a key difference between stories and other requirement practices. Estimation gives the business and technical perspectives a chance to interact, which creates value early, when an idea has the most potential. When the team knows the cost of features, it can split, combine, or extend scope based on what is known about the feature's value. So that's basically what Leff was just saying. Get the high level very early, something very lightweight. Give it a high-level estimation, even if it's an fitting estimation, and start talking with the stakeholders very quickly to determine the value and break it down. That's pretty much coming right from XP. So thoughts on that, guys?
I mean, that definitely gets into the agile side of it. I mean, right. And brings in the thing of user stories and and where we're heading next.
Okay.
Ultimately, like when you just kind of go back into requirements, like it depended on the flavor of requirements documents. And some of the problems that you run into with business requirements is when we sign them off. In Agile, there is no real necessarily sign off until the customer's seen it and said, hey, it's done. With a business requirements document, in most companies, you sign that sucker off right before you go to development. And then it's locked in. And anything that changes after that, usually some kind of PCR process. Towards the late, mid 2004, in a lot of waterfall companies that I worked at, you know, we had moved away from traditional thou shall kind of requirements and actually got buy-in to use cases. While a use case is, you know, a lot heavier weight than a user story, I mean, that is even a next jumping off point. So from the traditional types of requirements that we're used to, you know, a use case would be a good next transition to for the way we do requirements if we were in a traditional mindset. So just kind of want to bring back that all requirements documents aren't the thou shall and the JAD sessions and creating that giant feature separate doc that needs signed off. You know, just want to kind of bring that back around full circle, because a lot of what we've seen today, a lot of what Alistair Coburn was working on in the, you know, 90s at IBM and things like that, we're talking about use cases. So there was a shift from the traditional thou shall into use cases.
And I'll jump in right after you, James. I actually have a copy of that book on my desk, Writing Effective Use Cases by Alistair. I think you're correct. I think a use case is an interim step between a requirement and a story. I do think use cases can get very heavy, to your point. If you start covering all the happy path, non-happy path, weird sort of left and right-hand turns you can make. However, I do think use cases are usually more descriptive than a requirement. I would say that. I think they offer up a little bit more to interpretation. They're not as prescriptive as a requirement document, maybe. I think they offer a little bit more leeway into actually solutioning. As opposed to just writing a requirement, which basically says, I need the ham sandwich.
So early on in my career, we had a piece of software called Blueprint that would basically, you would develop your requirement within this tool, and it would help create that use case. So I do see benefit in use cases. What I tend to see in heavy requirement sort of waterfall transformation effort going into an Agile space is these heavy-handed requirements documents, as well as an entire team that writes use cases off those requirements as the traceability and audit. So we need to have that use case so we can prove that we solution for the requirement. So it becomes an artifact, and it actually becomes wasteful, because all you're doing is checking a box. So it's not looping that into the conversation of how we can utilize this use case thought within sort of the story writing exercise or through it, you know, whatever it may be. Right now, current client I'm working with, we literally, it's a trailing artifact. So we do all the story development, but because we need to check the use case box, we create that use case as a trailing, you know, it's almost like a definition of done before release.
Yeah. And we talked to, I was talking to one of the coaches that I work with at this current engagement, and we got into what he had to do. This was as of 2 years ago, when they would go to do, when they were doing work for the pharma industry and they were doing Agile, they would ultimately have to take every single user story in that they had created and turn that back into a business requirements document, a functional spec document that had a full trace matrix into the physical test cases. So they had to call out, you know, BO1, FO1, test case 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like literally, so even in some areas where we're able to get into the like a much better way to define requirements in a user story, they still have to go back and put those documents together. So there's some really intuitive ways, you can actually leverage tools today to kind of get to that. And I know that that's later on in the agenda, if it's still on there. But, you know, I think a lot of that, like, there is just that ticking and tying and so much waste with the traditional waterfall mindset and the way that waterfall requires to do requirements that it's pretty ridiculous.
I mean, but I think it also spins back into is when I ask the question, why do we need those requirements? Why do we need to document requirements, or why is the organization feel that this is what we have to do? And it's always a sort of interesting question to ask, because it doesn't seem to get answered very well. Well, that's because what we do, right? So I ring the bell, you eat the cheese. I'm conditioned to do that. It's because that's what I've been doing. So to get the mindset to shift and literally have that, you know, pivot point, it's trying to accomplish the same goal utilizing a different method. So that's where it's sort of, and I think Troy and I were going back and forth about this, a business requirement is not a user story. Well, it could be, right? I mean, you could essentially break a requirement down and create a story off that requirement. It may not be one and the same, but it's just changing sort of, if I just rename the requirement a user story and start building it within whatever ALM tool or whatever you're going to use, is it to say that that requirement doesn't become a user story?
Well, I guess they could become a user story, but on their own, I would say they're not a user story. I guess that's what I was saying.
I would agree.
But there are still some there's still some environments where, you know, people haven't started pressing the regulations, where no matter what, we're still going to have to do that kind of effort to not go to jail, to be in compliance, to not be fined. So, I mean, there are some, even though we're going to have that waste in some industries until agile practitioners start pushing regulators to see what lightweight documentations are and have an understanding of that and how that they can still satisfy those compliance, you know, efforts. So even if we can get companies fully agile, the regulators and the regulating bodies, ultimately, until we start working as practitioners to work with our legislators to change things in some of these industries, you're going to continuously be pushed to do some of those wasteful activities.
The old compliance and governance monster always seems to rear its head whenever we're trying to do exciting things. If nobody minds, I'd like to sort of pivot the discussion. Let's start talking about user stories. I know Lev had a definition somewhere floating around of what a user story is. I think we'd like to touch on that, but I really would like to dig into one of our discussion points is about story quality. And is it more important to have high quality, well-written stories, or is the emphasis really on just getting enough of a story together to have a good conversation? Lev, you want to start with that one?
Yeah. So to me, it's always sort of the discussion around, you know, when coaching a team or even from a product owner perspective, how do you write a user story? You know, what is a user story? How do we even start this effort? So it's not, and it's interesting because a lot of times it's, well, the product owner needs to write the user story. It's the product owner. And it's less about who's writing the user story and more about who's talking about it. Like, who's in the room actually having the discussion. So, you know, from a team perspective, is the team helping write that user story? The product owner could start the user story, but who's collaborating on it? Are there enough sort of thinking bodies in the room to actually understand what needs to get done and basically break that down into a way people understand?
So Andrew, I can chime in on this one. Team I'm currently working with, the BA writes all the user stories. So the BA sits in the meetings with the stakeholders, with the product owner, which is great. And they go over user stories and they have some little workshops with that, which is great. But one of the things I'm going to encourage is that the rest of the team sit in those meetings too when they can. You know, so this way, it's not always just on the BA to do all the user story work. So that's one of the things that a team does. So the product owner actually doesn't even write any user stories on this team currently.
Well, so is the BA just the proxy then of the user of the product owner?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, if you ultimately boil it down to, you know, what it says in the Scrum Guide, I mean, anybody can technically write a user story.
Sure. That's what I was trying to say is that I want the team to be there so the team can start feeling like, oh, I can write these too, or they would want to help write them, hopefully.
And I mean, ultimately, if you look back to, you know, the stuff that Ron Jeffries wrote in the beginning, it was all about the card, the conversation, and the confirmation. And having enough detail in that user story to at least start that conversation. And it has that syntax of, as a person, entity, user, I need something so that I get X, Y, and Z value out of it. I mean, that's ultimately, that's where that conversation starts. And, you know, if you look at what Jeff Patton did with the story map, he encourages people to use verb titles, because verb titles can easily start to become that formula that talks about the what I need, the who, the what, and the why. And that's ultimately that gap of that traditional business requirement. And when we start that conversation, we get into the card, the conversation and that confirmation, we need the who, what, and why so that teams are delivering against valuable software.
So let me ask an odd sort of question there. So traditional user stories are as a who, I need to be able to what, as a blank, I should blank so that I can blank. What's the most important part of a user story? The who, the what, or the why? My opinion is the why. Because if you tell me why you need something, maybe the what changes based upon my knowledge or knowledge of my peers or just institutional knowledge, tribal knowledge, what have you. Would you say that that's the most important part, James? The why, or is it the who or the what?
So speaking from a development experience, my thought process always goes to the why you need it. And I'm going to look for coding solutions that ultimately, understanding the why allows me to creatively develop solutions to solve the ask. So I always want to know why you have it. I want to know the value and why I'm developing this for you. Because personally, when I'm developing from a cold set of stale user or from cold stale set of business requirements, I could care less why I'm developing this for you. But as soon as you tell me who you are, what you need, and why I'm doing it for you, I can start to build a relationship. I can start to build a mental model of who you are, envision you as Jay Hersko sitting at this computer trying to fill out this TPS report and go, dude, this dude's life is miserable. You know, maybe we fix the process here, here, and here, and I can make that suggestion. And then I code this solution that automates the other three quarters of his job. And now he can spend more time doing other important things. So it, for me, it's always the why that I need it to kind of tailor that back.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And the last team I was working with, one of the big breakthroughs that I noticed in our meetings was when they started talking about exactly that why. Why are we doing this? Also, they started thinking about how the user interacts with it. And they started saying, well, you know, they started putting themselves in the perspective of the end user, which was never the case before, you know. And that took time to get that, but through user story refinement, the team started to sink in. So, but I do agree the why is definitely the most important, in my opinion.
See, I'm not sure I necessarily agree that the why is the most important. I think the why can drive a different conversation. The who and the what helps keep things at a small, you know, snippet. So literally, if you just focus on the why, you might write too big of a story, right? So if the goal is to have a small user story or a smaller story, just one story, not talking, you know, epics and features, so forth, you can, those other parts of a user story help define sort of that size,
right?
So sure. it can it can go in different directions. So I think they're all sort of, they play an equal part in the discussion. I'm not sure I just would want to focus on the why. I mean, we're all focusing on what business value is this providing and how does this tie into that? So to me, the why is a bigger conversation.
So the what is interesting because focusing on the what can actually make the story too small. I can try to explain. Like, for instance, there's an example. I sat in a session the other day where the product owner was with the stakeholders and I was just observing. And he wrote a user story, which was something about, you know, as a user, I want to uncheck this checkbox so that I can do something, so that I can unregister for the email or whatever, right? And I didn't say anything at the time, but that is too small of a story because the user doesn't want to uncheck a checkbox. The user wants to unregister for the email, right? So the checkbox should be up to negotiation, in my opinion, you know, as far as how the best way for this feature to work, you know, for the unregistering for the email, right? And that's supposed to be negotiation between the team and the business side. So that, in my opinion, that's an example of focusing too much on the what and making it too small. And, you know, not making it negotiable.
And in that case, Troy, though,
yeah,
even though it's way too small,
and right,
I start solutioning,
right,
because you've brought in that checkbox,
right,
it's potentially still independent.
Well, yeah, it's independent, so, but it's no longer negotiable.
When we start talking about the what and Andrew's point of getting too small, you know, one of the big problems that I see today is that every user story that these people write, they try to get them small enough that it's one day's worth of work. But by doing that, they've lost the independence of the story. So when we start getting into invest, and I'm assuming that invest is going to slowly work its way into this conversation, but I mean, ultimately, when we start talking about a good user story, you know, it needs to be at the heart of it. It needs to be independent.
Sure,
it needs to be valuable. So, you know, fundamentally, we need to make sure that those top two, you know, independent and valuable, are probably, in my mind, the most important things out of Invest.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of the reason that user stories might be, you know, the evolution, you know, as if we can call it that, you know, prefer to use them is they are faster. It's more adaptable. It's less rigid, and there is the ability to change within that. It definitely fosters, you know, a much broader collaborative sort of effort. It provides the, you know, from a delivery perspective, a team with, you know, much deeper context. And it really comes down to, it's closer to what the customer actually wants versus what they told someone they wanted, you know, months ago. And then that was interpreted into a business requirement. So your customers, you know, could essentially write user stories. That might be way too radical, but it's not where the stakeholder or customer is talking to a BA and that BA is interpreting the what and then capturing that in the system shell. So it just, plus it builds in a level of quality from a user story perspective that I don't think, and I could be completely wrong, business requirements necessarily have any quality built into them.
So to that point, is a requirement the same as a user story? James?
I'm going to have to plead the fifth on that one.
Well, I think if we go back to that couple paragraphs I read off earlier, Kent Beck would say no, but that's...
I'll give you the agile answer. It depends.
Did Mike McCallis sneak onto the podcast again?
Yeah.
No, I mean, ultimately, so if you look at a business requirement, it talks mainly about the what. When you start looking at the user story, it talks about the who, the what, the why. And hey, even it might even get into the when. And then when the users, and ultimately when the development team adds their tasks onto that story, it gets into the how. So a business requirement is really one dimensional. A user story has the five dimensions. It has the fifth element that, you know, ultimately where, you know, creates a, we need to edit that piece out.
No, we got to leave that in.
I'm trying to inject weird movie references.
I can do that like subtly and see if you guys notice. Okay.
But ultimately, I mean, when you look at it, it is physically just a bit physical core old school business requirement is talking about the what. When you talk about the user story, you're talking about the who, what, why, potentially the when. And then when you add in the acceptance criteria, you start adding in the quality elements. So when you're talking about that, and we haven't even got into the definition of done. Like when we know that a requirement is done. You right, definitely, you don't get that in a traditional business requirement.
But I think that the basis of what a requirement was supposed to be was define the what. The team will define the how, or the developers will define the how, which is very similar to what the user story is sort of encapsulating too. So literally, if you're addressing the five W's, the who, what, where, when, and why, you sort of leave the how to the team, right? So again, it's in basis, in mindset, you could say it's similar or close to being the same if you were looking at it that way. So it might be in a purist form, you know, a requirement might be just, you know, a less collaborative way to write a user story or a less collaborative way to define sort of the what, because it's just harder to do.
Not to cut you off, Andrew.
No.
You brought up a good point, you know, requirements being less collaborative. In my experience as an analyst, and I like to think I was a pretty good one, but there are probably tons of people out there that said I wasn't. It was not very collaborative at all. It was more of throwing things back and forth over a wall. I go sit with the business and say, okay, here's what you need. And I would write that up and then throw it back over. Does this look right? Okay. And you throw it to the developer. Does this look right? It's not collaborative in any way, shape, or form. Whereas a user story, my opinion is user story authorship and reviewing that as part of the Scrum ceremony or Agile ceremony, I find that gets better mileage, better feedback, better input, and it's less descriptive and more prescriptive. Troy, what do you think?
No, I agree 100%. And something else, just kind of interjecting, is something else a lot of people, I don't even think they realize, is that user stories are not part of Scrum. So
right.
I think they are. So you can actually use any kind of requirements, you know, if you're quote unquote doing Scrum, right? But I would say that BRDs, going back to our original conversation, don't lend themselves to being agile. So since Scrum is a framework of agile, you can make up your own mind about that. But yeah, they're definitely not required if you're doing Scrum.
Yeah, and I like the way you put that, Jay, in the sense of, I used to think of, it's almost like the evolution of the internet. So literally requirements remind me of, and I'm going to date myself here and probably no one will know what I'm talking about, but we used to call it sneaker net, right? We would have something on a disk, we would put it in the computer and then we would copy it to that disk and then we would walk it over to another computer, pop that in there and then you could review it. So requirements were very similar to that. You would write them down and then you would walk it over to someone else and talk about it. So similar to what you were saying about kicking it over the fence. And then, you know, along comes better ways to communicate that are faster, more effective and actually drive broader conversations. So could a user story essentially, going back to the way that Troy sort of discussed it, the evolution of what a requirement is today. So in the software development world, is a user story just an evolution of what business requirements were?
I mean, a logical evolution, in my opinion, working with customers, working with the stakeholders, seems like a logical next step from where it was before.
So one of the things that I ran into as an analyst, and I'm curious to hear what you guys' thoughts are on this, is requirements creep, right? So traditionally in a waterfall-driven SDLC, you get the business requirements and they get turned into functional requirements, which then goes to someone else who designs the technical requirements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I found that as you were authoring what amounts to functional requirements off of business requirements, you were redefining the business requirements as you were going, because as you were authoring your functionals, you were working with the business to say, well, that doesn't make sense. You asked for peanut butter and banana, well, you really want peanut butter and jelly. So my requirements were changing, and I was updating theirs, and I think James was the one who brought it up before about how we accept business requirements, sign off on them, and say, okay, they're set in stone, they're done, when in reality they never are. What are you guys' thoughts on the requirements creep, where you know those lines of delineation between a business requirement, a functional requirement, a technical requirement, a solution requirement, they get blurry very, 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 very fast. What are you guys' thoughts on that in regards to a requirement versus a user story?
I think there's creep in both. So I literally think there's requirements creep and scope creep, whatever we want to call it, in both scenarios. But what I think through the user story exercise, you find out quicker. So you get to that point a lot quicker than you would with going through, you know, business requirements broken down into functional requirements, broken down into technical requirements. You could be talking months. You know, with the user story, you're having that conversation and it's, you know, it's constant. You're constantly refining a backlog and you're constantly refining until you, you know, go into sprint planning and sort of, I don't want to say lock the scope in, but lock this, or, you know, sort of have that sprint goal defined, what you're going to be delivering at the end of that increment. So to me, it's just the way you manage it. There's creep in both. And like I said, it's just, you find out quicker with sort of the user story exercise.
James?
But I mean, ultimately, is there actually creep in Agile? I mean, when you look at Agile, you're supposed to be floating the scope. You're supposed to be looking at the business value, measurable, actionable business outcomes that says we plan to do X, Y, and Z. And as we get that feedback loop in from our customers, if we did not actually hit that mark, we should just stop doing this. Like, where in the traditional business requirements and the current client that I'm at, it is the, we've got $1 million. We're going to death mark that $1 million till we've spent the entire purse. With Agile, it's ultimately about understanding, did we meet the customer's needs? Is it delivering value? And if it's not, let's stop spending money on it. It starts bringing in those concepts of the lean startup. So as you start bringing in that build, measure, learn cycle into actual user stories, then, you know, there isn't creep. It's a constant strive to deliver business value. And as business, and as people start to realize the value that is delivered, then the money actually starts to become less relevant in Agile. Where in Waterfall, it is a very fixed budget, very fixed cost, very scope creep driven way of looking at work. So if you start bringing in the Agile mindset, it's about bringing in those concepts from the lean startup and that build, measure, learn cycle, and the scope creep conversation actually stops. It's about, are we delivering value?
So I have an odd sort of question. So the 7 software illities, right? The non-functional requirements: usability, maintainability, scalability, availability, blah 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 blah.
Definition of done.
So if that goes into the definition of done, doesn't that make the story unwieldy to the point where you're almost better off writing a requirements document? James?
You're voted off the uprising, Jay.
Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, it depends. I mean, oh God. Like McCalla and his angels. I mean, it depends in a sense that at the last client we were at, Andrew and I were there slugging it out with some great people in the pharma industry. And when we started looking at those non-functional requirements, we ended up having to break it down and for like browser testing. So, I mean, they had a browser list that was like, I mean, they were getting into even Opera. Like, who the hell uses Opera? But ideally, what we ended up doing was you know, we spread those non-functional requirements out so that it was manageable across the 9 teams. So that not every particular set of teams had to worry about every single part of the, you know, those non-functional requirements. Because through the testing of the 9 different teams, they hit on those weird NFRs.
I like that. That's a good approach. I like that a lot. I never thought of that.
Because you could have multiple, and, you know, again, in my thought is you can have multiple teams working on a feature, right? Or no?
Yes.
Yes.
So if you're all rolling up to a feature or, you know, a larger body of work, you have to be able to track whether that feature is growing and what you've slotted for a release. Let's say you have a release in 4 months and that feature needs to be released, then you've defined that MVP. So if your MVP is X, you have to be able to manage that sort of scope creep, right? Because if you're constantly adding to that MVP, you're never going to be able to get done.
Troy, thoughts?
No, I'm good. I just had a question for you guys about acceptance criteria. Just wanted to get your thoughts about that, because that's actually not part of Scrum, and it's not, to my knowledge, it's not part of XP. So I was just curious of where did the acceptance criteria idea originally come from? We don't have to talk about this now. I can edit it. But I just thought about that.
No, I think it's go on, Lef.
No, I don't think I have a good answer for that.
I know I don't. I think this... Troy, you may have uncovered another podcast discussion. Okay. On acceptance criteria. Yeah. James?
Okay. Yeah, I'm just for the sake of the rambling that is about to come out of my mouth, we'll just save that for another
podcast. Okay, fair enough.
I mean, I think it probably came out of the QA world, right? So how do we test? How do we define that this is, you know, we've built in quality and acceptance criteria? Well, basically, you know, we're going to sign off on this and say it's accepted based upon this set of criteria that sort of, you know, is in line with what, with the what.
Okay.
And I mean, if you look at, you know, if you look, and I'm going to open this up, I'm going to Lockhart you guys. A lot of the acceptance criteria, when I started doing it, it tied directly into the definition of done. Mm-hmm. So we knew how we knew officially with that acceptance criteria that it was done. And then as we found BDD, which is your behavior driven development, your automation number at the, you know, that middle tier of the testing pyramid, that acceptance test criteria ultimately became that behavior driven development to do more automated testing.
Right. So
writing things in that given when then format for, so that your business analyst can actually write automated tests. It doesn't need to fall on your developer. So, I mean, I think to Andrew's point, or it was Jay's point, it did come out of the testing world. It does tie into that definition of done. And we could probably spend an entire podcast talking about what the heck good acceptance criteria looks like.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Let's add that to the backlog, because that is definitely something, in my current engagement, we struggle with, is to your point, James, good acceptance criteria. I mean, good user stories, there's a lot more literature about, but when it comes to writing good quality acceptance criteria, I would dare say a lot of companies probably struggle with that, and that's maybe something we should explore in a later episode.
And I'm going to pop back in here for just one more point on that. And if you look at, and I hate going to Dean's book, but if you look at what Leffingwell wrote and some of the other blogs that they wrote that have been written about story splitting, sometimes you split stories based upon your acceptance criteria. Because I know that everybody's concern is do we have too much damn acceptance criteria, and are these stories freaking gigantic? Well, yeah, but we can split them on the acceptance criteria, because if what you have is literally unicorns, like, do we need to, in this release, do we need to focus on the unicorns in this acceptance criteria?
Can you give me an example of a unicorn?
So
it's a horse with a horn on it.
Right. Okay.
We ultimately had this. So when we built an authorized contact system for a large financial institution. And when we had to make the decision to go live with what the functionality that we had, we found a scenario where there was a combination set of authority signers that there was, out of the data set that we looked at, there was literally a 1 in 2.3 million occurrence, like chance of occurrence of this particular acceptance criteria. So did we want to waste time and try to build for the unicorn, or did we want to go and get it live, start getting that feedback and validate that we're building that right thing? So right there was an acceptance criteria thing that we knew it was a risk. The product owner was acceptance of that risk because it was a 1 in 2 million chance of this actually happening. Okay. So those are the types of unicorn scenarios that it may make sense to go ahead and do it. It also may make sense to say, you know, it may be a bad user experience, but at least we're getting feedback. So we may be able to create a brand new record. We may not be able to go back in and make sure that being able to update it, if that was part of your acceptance criteria.
Right.
So you could split it out, and in the first release of this, you can either create or delete in the CRUD operation. There's no update. So the update could have been part of that acceptance criteria that you split out into its own individual user story. It literally reads almost like the exact same user story as it did before, but the scenarios that you're working on is an enhancement to a smaller subset of functionality that we've previously delivered.
So, cool. Thank you for that explanation.
I kind of want to go back to something, and I don't know, it's just a story popped into my head and it might be relevant. I always find it, I think it's a good story. So years and years ago, I was working as a BA, right? For about 15 months, we were developing a system. So we did about 6 months worth of requirements analysis, and then we went into the development cycle. So it was to go into, we were doing an electronic, so taking a recorder of deeds from all paper and ledgers and dockets to basically an online sort of paperless system. So to fast forward, we went live, right? It was very exciting. It was a big deal. Here we have this fancy, slick new product, one of the first in the industry. And the first customer comes to the counter, wants to pay for something, and literally they go to pay for it, and there was no way to give the person change.
Oh.
So here we had accounted for all this really high-tech, super slick stuff, and yet we never ever caught that we never captured a way to do any of the accounting, right? So someone just coming in to pay for it, never figured it out. So here we are almost 16, 17 months in, a lot of money was spent, and we couldn't do the simplest of functions. So that to me was sort of was an eye-opening experience through the whole requirements documentation and gathering all this business need. No one ever thought of the simple stuff. So, you know, that probably wouldn't have happened if we were operating in a much more iterative, quicker fashion, right? We probably would have caught that a lot sooner because there would have been those checks and balances in there. But right. I find that to be an interesting way to sort of showcase how, you know, business requirements really capture a lot of stuff, and it becomes almost all the stuff at right. one point. Big data dump.
So no one ever thought of, as a user, I want to receive my change.
Correct.
it's actually, that's an awesome story. If anybody has ever read The Agile Samurai, there's a great infographic which talks about one of the reasons why Waterfall is one of the most suboptimal ways to deliver a project. And the first point is you will never be able to document everything in its entirety of what you need up front. And that's a perfect example, right? Everybody was so worried about the abilities, scalability, scalability. Nobody ever said, hey, what happens if it's 9:48 and James hands me a $10 bill?
Yep. So it's just, it's an amazing sort of thought process. And, you know, everyone needs that. I think they say this in SAFE, don't they? That aha moment. So literally it's that aha moment sort of understanding, well, how do we not run into this again? So it was just, I don't know, it popped in my head while we were sitting here talking about it. So I thought I would just throw that out there too.
Cool. Thank you. What's the next topic, guys?
I think one of the things we wanted to talk about was, can you simultaneously have both requirements and user stories? Does whatever type of agile flavor of scale, whatever you've done, can we accommodate both requirements and user stories? I'll go first. I'll say yes. In my current engagement, it's a little bit of an isolated incident in the sense that we are working with a vendor which is 100% agile. However, my current employer is more waterfall centric. So we are actually working, collaborating with the vendor to write what amounts to feature documents, which are basically requirements. We review them with the product owners from both the vendor and from us. We get sign off, and then those go to the actual development teams, which write user stories. So my answer to that question is yes, you can have both a feature document requirement and a user story. Andrew, what's been your experience with that?
So I also believe, yes, you can have both, but I think to me, it's more of changing the name. So I try to, and you sort of did it in your founders, you know, your, what you just illustrated, you said it as well, where I try and steer away from calling them requirements and move them to features or, you know, something other than a requirement, because it's, you know, for companies that are, you know, have done waterfall for so many years, that has a strong meaning behind it. So if there's a way to sort of break that, you know, process in their head or in someone's head that we're not calling this a requirement, it's going to embody a different set of values now that we're going to call it a feature or a unicorn or whatever we want to call it, a hippo. You know, literally it takes on a different life. So I do think they can coexist. I just think you have to change almost the name behind it to help break some of the pattern.
Cool. I don't have much to add to this section, guys. So
I know James and I were going back and forth on this earlier. So yeah.
I mean, ultimately, so Andrew and I, in the last engagement that we were on together, we ran into this where we physically had agile teams and we had traditional waterfall teams. And at some level, you have product owners writing actual business requirements to interact with the waterfall team that was handling, you know, they were handling some more of the finer points of the, you know, the ERP system that we were working on. And we were working on the new modern pieces. And we were integrating a really slick new technology in the e-commerce platform space with a lot of legacy teams that had to do, you know, basically flip over some ETL jobs to start feeding the new platform. So, and in that case, we literally had user stories and business requirements working together. And, you know, Andrew definitely, you know, helped them change the mindset to talk to them about more of a featured style, which allowed them to have shorter phases of actual requirements building and delivery to the agile team. So it was this, it was a, you know, a blend between that system and that team. And then we also did the same type of practices when we went to the five external vendors that we were also trying to integrate with their, you know, the controlled substances that the FDA has to regulate, with some controlled substance processing that we had to deal with in this commerce platform. And we changed the mindset of how that worked, but it was literally business requirements and user stories living together, working together, and actually being related to. And so,
mass hysteria.
No, go ahead, Andrew. And I definitely think that, you know, this is a great opportunity since we shared this experience that you could also weigh in on that, because it was really harmonious.
No, it was, and it was. So before that sort of project, which, you know, it was easier to do that based upon, at another organization that I had worked at, we had such pushback from the business, and this is where business requirements couldn't cohabitate with stories. So we had the challenge of saying, we're not going to wait for these comprehensive requirements documents, these huge BRDs. So we'll take the ones you have and we're going to break them down into stories from a team standpoint. So the business would not back off of writing these BRDs. So what ended up happening was we would take their BRDs and we would break them down into user stories. And we proved that we could out-develop and actually release software faster than they could feed us business requirements documents. So through that exercise, we actually proved that we could actually, with our own minds, base our a product that was going live based off these comprehensive documents, and we could do it faster than the business could provide us with requirements. So it was from that standpoint, that was the pivot point to say, why are we wasting all this time? Let's focus on really what the feature is, or what the project, which we define them as projects at that point, what that needs to be. And let's not just focus on writing comprehensive documentation because compliance says we have to. You know, we could go back into that, but it's literally changing that mindset. And you know, the project James was referring to, it was a great win to be able to alter sort of that mindset, and it was in a short amount of time. So I've seen both sides of it, where requirements are a must have and the business won't back off, and literally you can prove them wrong if you can spin up teams to break requirements down in the stories. You can actually out develop what the business can provide.
So I know we're quickly approaching the 60 minute mark. So one of the last things I think we wanted to cover was requirements management, user story management, and tool sets. So what type of tooling has everybody used to manage both requirements and user stories, traceability, et cetera, et cetera. Troy, what's the kind of stuff that you've come across in your travels?
Well, anything from physical sticky notes, which are my favorite, actually, to Jira. Most of my experience has been with Jira, and for the good and bad. So there's some frustrations with Jira. But overall, I mean, we're getting the job done, so.
I've used Jira, obviously. Rally and version 1 for story management. For requirements management, it's been a hodgepodge of homegrown systems. I've seen Excel. The scariest application I've ever used, and I'm going to ruin the sponsorship opportunity, so I'm sorry, guys. It's IBM Rational Doors. I'm assuming I just heard a couple of groans. So the UI is not anything to write home about. It stands for Rational Dynamic Object Oriented Requirements System. And it was absolutely brutal. And that tool was really, to me, it was more for waterfall type traceability. So James, you talked before about compliance and governance and being able to trace all the way back. That was the big benefit of that tool. However, the UI was absolutely god awful, and navigation was the pits. And I got like 3 hours away from being certified, and I actually left that job and went to somewhere else. It was absolutely brutal.
I'm really offended. I designed that UI, so
I don't think you're nearly old enough, but Andrew probably did. He made some remarks before about stuff that, you know.
Andrew was managing requirements in an Access database. Let's be real.
It wasn't Access. It was Fox Pro or Power Builder or something, I think.
I mean, but, so ultimately, from a requirements management standpoint, I've built in my career 4 different versions of a SharePoint-based requirements generation tool. So if you ever need help and your company's stuck on SharePoint 2010 and you have InfoPath, I can teach you how to build requirements, creating solutions for Agile, Waterfall, whatever you need. I got the code ready to go. But for the most part, it's been the major suites. I mean, I've pretty much worked with everything from Axosoft, LeanKit, like any major tool vendor that's been out there, I've used it in some way to either generate requirements or user stories. I think that there's a lot of, Andrew and I have been kind of going back and forth about how to make Waterfall better. If we could interact with the PMI folks and give them pieces of Agile to make Waterfall better. And, you know, as you look at what David Anderson promoted in his book about the transition to Kanban, it's respect what you do today and agree to continuously improve. There are ways to use Jira and even Rally with Confluence to create robust BPM sign-off type business requirements document that bring in code, that bring in your tech spec, that create your functional document. And you can do it all within these tools. We've done Rally to Confluence integration. We've done Jira to Confluence. And instead of using that traditional, you know, Word document that everybody signs off, and in some industries you literally have to have a printout of that with 19 people's signatures on it, there are ways to be compliant and use those tools to create the documentation that you need. It's just an intelligent way of looking at the features in those tools to actually expand upon that.
So I'm going through that right now, actually, James. I'm working with a team who's been a Waterfall team their whole existence. And we're supposed to spin up a Scrum team from this team, but that's not happening probably for another 5 to 8 weeks. I'm not exactly sure. So what I did was I just kind of converted what they were doing to Kanban. So, you know, we're just doing that, and then, but we're doing it a flow-based, and we're, you know, got in some stand-ups and trying to do some self-organization. Other than that, though, there's not much process. So I basically what I'm saying is I can relate to that because it's something I'm going through right now.
Yep, and I mean, I could do it, we could do an entire podcast about, you know, transitioning from Waterfall to and growing practices like hands down, you know, and we've used that, Troy. I've used that same concept multiple times to get people delivering, you know, user stories. Jira right now has the capability to bring in line items as you create issues. So you could create an issue type that is actual business requirement. But eventually the details of that can become a user story. You can bring all those into Confluence and actually turn those into functional docs or tech specs. And I mean, it's just fundamentally the tools keep getting better. And I'd love to hear Andrew weigh in on some of this stuff as we've ultimately tangled with a lot of this kind of stuff together.
Yeah, so one of the tools that I don't know if you guys have had exposure to, and I've worked with it throughout the years, is Blueprint. They actually have, you know, part of their software suite is called Storyteller. So, you know, you create stories within the tool. And this is what I used for requirements documentation years ago. And they actually sort of mimic the way you would write a story. And then you can actually generate automated test scripts right off the story. So it's kind of an interesting tool. Not really sure why more companies don't use it, and I have no affiliation with Blueprint, so I don't get any sort of kickback for talking about them. But it's a different tool that I don't see a lot of companies using. So it integrates with a lot of the other ALM tools that are out there. So just from my experience, I've used it in the Waterfall methodology as well as a little bit within the Agile framework as well.
So we good to wrap it up?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have anything going on? How can we actually find you guys? So, I mean, if people that are listening to this want to reach out to you to continue this conversation, how are we going to find you on the web?
Okay, so I'll go first. First, you can go to agileuprising.com, check out everything we got going on there. From there, you can check out the coalition. The link is there. The actual URL is coalition.agileuprising.com. And we are all on the coalition, and it's a free board which you can go and join in the discussion. You can just read. You can ask questions. And one other thing, if you have a question you'd like to have discussed on a future podcast, there is a thread there as well called Podcast Listener Questions, so feel free to post there. On Twitter, though, my Twitter ID is G4STroy.
Mike Troy, I'm floating around on the Agile Uprising, so feel free to look me up through there. If you're looking for me on Twitter, I am at Backdoor Agile.
Amazing.
Well, the best if you're at a company and they don't. My thing is, if they're not really hungry to bring in iterative methodologies, if you're fighting budget constraints, well, sneak it in the back door. Why not?
You can find me all over the Agile Uprising. User ID on there is at Scrimando. You can find me on Twitter at Scrimando. And you can find me infrequently blogging at Scrimando.com. Notice the theme.
Yeah, and like everyone else said, I'm also all over the coalition, and you can follow me on Twitter at Lean Left, or read my less frequent blogs than Scrimando's at leanleft.com.
Very cool. Well, thanks a lot, guys, and thanks for listening.